The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 444, recorded on October 26th, 2016. Welcome to the 444th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 277th episode of the Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
I am TJ Denzer.
I am Scott Dirk.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry. So a lot has been going on this past week. It's unfortunate that the biggest news that we had in a long while happened the day after, although we knew it was happening. We knew it was going to happen, and you know, the fact that I knew it was going to happen, I should have just delayed the podcast one day just to get our reactions. But one of the things, the biggest things that happened was that Civ 6 was released, and all three of us played in the Turncast. Now, what's odd is that Scott played at the same time that I did, but we were playing separate games. But we were listening to each other play separate games.
Yeah,
that was fun. And meanwhile, I'm assuming that TJ, you played later on in the day.
Yeah, me and Scott played in the same game and I played.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, let's go with first impressions. Scott, how about you? You go first.
It's a really different game from Civ 5. It feels like there's more thinking because you have to plan out your tiles and pay attention to the terrain that you're given. And the music is really great. And, again, it is a really different game. You have to really plan things differently. You don't have to worry about...
I wouldn't say it's that different, because you still have the same mechanics. Move your units, settle cities, find the best locations.
Yeah, if you want to boil it down to very basic concept, yeah, it's very similar. Right. But there are broader things that are different. For instance, you don't have to worry about global happiness anymore. That's no longer crimping you. You don't have to worry about puppeting cities. You can immediately own them. Again, the traders building roads, so you don't have to worry about workers doing that.
You don't even have workers anymore.
You have builders, and so you have to time when you want them and what things are going to improve. So, you know, in a broader sense, there's more details that make it different. You know, it's still a Civ game, but it's a different flavor, you know?
Well, let me tell you something. There are small touches, which Ed Beach, who is the lead designer, he also is the lead designer, I believe, for Gods and Kings and Brave New World, the expansions, that only a longtime Civ player would do. For instance, when you're piloting your non-combat units, your builders, your settlers, you can now link your military unit to them, so you don't have to constantly match your military unit to where your non-military unit is going, so that they won't get captured when they're attacked. You know, you no longer have to keep an eye on it. You know, you can just have them link together and have them go to where you want to go, and you know that if they're attacked, at least you have a unit there that's going to defend it automatically.
Yeah. That is one difference as well.
The other thing that's a major difference is that you can run out of great people. For instance, I was playing a game as Spain, and for whatever reason, England decided to snatch up all the great prophets and other things. So when it was my turn to have a great prophet, guess what? There are no great prophets left.
You can only get one great prophet per Civ, because all they do is found a religion. So the other
I was not able to found a religion because all the great prophets were used.
And you can only if you can run out of the other great people. I think it's just the great prophet that runs out.
And I think you can only have six religions per game.
Yeah, depending on your speed setting and whatnot.
Yeah, so that was a little bit of shock, especially since Spain's big thing is their use of religion.
Yeah, I missed out on religion as well, but it's okay.
But that only influenced me to stock up on tech and culture. There are other small things, but TJ, you've been silent. Why don't you throw in now?
I mean, I don't have a first impression. This is like my fifth impression. I've been talking about this for a while. I had fun. Egypt was not one of the ones in the... I ended up playing Egypt, and Egypt was not one of the civs that was in the preview build. So I got to see how the reworked Egypt goes, and they're just as big on monuments and culture pieces as they ever were. But I ended up having a civ that was on a river and next to an ocean. So
oh dear God.
You had the pyramids, the lighthouse, the Colosseum.
Oh God, I had it all. I think I built every one. I built just about every one of the early wonders, except for the Hagia Sophia. No, not Hagia.
Well, that's what I was doing in my game. I was building all the wonders as well. And I was in second place when we decided to call it quits.
Yeah, I was in first place on a culture victory, but from what I understand, looked like I hadn't met Brazil, but it sounded like they were pretty far along. They had already gotten to the atomic era by the time we stopped. And
well, we didn't quite get that far. We only made it to I think the Renaissance.
Yeah,
Renaissance. But. So one of the major changes that we have to talk about is that there's now two tech trees, essentially. So you have your regular tech tree, and you also have the culture. Not is it cult? No, it's
civics.
Civics tech tree, in which you're choosing I forgot the name of it again. I know it's a D word. Anyway, you decide what your cities, what kind of civics that your government is going to employ. At the beginning, you only have two civics. One is military, the other one is economic. And you have to change your government to get more civs. Now, what happens is that each of the governments gives you different. Like oligarchy gets you one of each. While a classical republic will get you two economic and one of each, but it won't have any military diploma. Oh, damn it. You know, it's not diplomacy. It's something else. And I'm stumbling over the word. You know what the word is, right?
Policy, I thought. Yeah.
Policy, that's it. That's what I was thinking of, policy. So it's a really clever way. And by the way, the civ that gets the extra policy, which I believe is Greece,
yeah,
or at least Athens, Greece, that is a real game changer, because you have one free wild policy at all times. And that allows you to get... See, there are purple policies, which don't fit into the first three, that it can only fit into the wild. Yeah. So now you're able to either generate points for a great scientist or a great prophet or a great writer before anybody else can.
I think people are sleeping on Germany a little bit. I've heard people talking about they're not getting enough progression or production. And... Oh my God! Have they not played Germany? Germany gets a second military policy for one, so they can slot that in right from the get go. And they get the Hansa district, which gains additional production value based on adjacency bonuses. And by the time you get to the Hansa, and Germany gets one more district per city based on citizenry than anyone else. So based on that, like based on those last two bonuses, the Hansa and the district bonus, you can push Germany into a production powerhouse in as early as like the classical era.
Yeah, apparently you also need to what's called stack your districts. You have three cities close enough together that they can have adjacent industrial districts, and so they can share the production, and that really boosts their production.
Well, there's also if you happen to be Russia and you have the if you build your holy site next to a tundra, and then you get the policy that actually boosts holy sites when they're near each other, you can really generate a lot of faith that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one of the things I noticed about the game is also that a lot of the annoyances of past civs, for instance, remember when you had to upgrade units, you had to choose either to heal them or give them a special ability. Now when you get a special ability, it gives them 50 hit points back. So you don't have to worry about choosing between healing your unit and giving them an ability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, districts now, the encampment especially, really makes it useful for the ranged units, because if you give your ranged units the +10 for firing, for attacking from either the city center or from a district, now your encampments actually have views. Oh, and that's the other thing about this game, too. One of the big additions that we haven't mentioned yet is housing. You can't make your cities as big as possible just like that anymore. Now you have to have enough housing for your people. Yes. And encampments and barracks give you housing, making them a must-to-have now. Before, you could get away with not having a barracks, right? You know, so what if my units don't get an XP bonus? Now? Yeah, you need the barracks just to get more housing.
Yeah, Granary gives housing, and there's some Wonders, I think, give housing. And there's various ways to get more housing.
But Granary was always useful in growing a city, though. Granary was always useful in growing a city. Now, you have to consider the other stuff.
Yeah. And we haven't had this limit since, like, Civ 2, where they had the aqueduct and sewer system giving this issue. Now you have to think about it and keep your cities big, or get them big. You need to build these things or keep them
small. Oh, yeah, mounts are now useful thanks to the aqueduct.
Mm-hmm.
Another aspect of the game is each hex has their own attractiveness to people, and now mountains are useful in that they're all breathtaking. They have the highest level 4. And if you have just the regular plains, -1. People are bored by the plain, the grasslands. So, yeah, you have to have amenities now, because now you have internal tourism as well as external tourism. I mean, there's so much there. Hey, look, Scott, why don't you get into some of the... gameplay mechanics that have surprised you the most in Civ 6?
Let's see. I think I was very surprised with the trade routes. Apparently, you can get many trade routes. You're not limited by like 7 or whatever. Or you. I think you have to build commerce centers, harbors, and other things, and you get up to like 20 trade routes. It's crazy high. The city-states, it's nice you don't have to manage their happiness with you.
Oh, yeah, now you just send them envoys. You don't have to send them money anymore.
Right. Or, I mean, they don't degrade over time. They just have a certain amount of envoys, and it's stable, you know? It's not like you don't have to babysit them. I was also kind of surprised that they don't really seem to care about the barbarians anymore. They used to, but now they have other quests.
I see what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, I do know that they will go after the barbarians themselves. One thing about the city-states is that the number of envoys you send increases your standing with them, and you get a special bonus each time. You also get a bonus if you're the suzerain, which is if you have 3 or more and you have the most envoys in that city. One of the things, though, is that every time you send an envoy, it makes the city-state grow. So you have to be careful if that city-state is next to you, because you don't want it growing too fast. You want to get that yummy land that it might be near, and you don't want it to grow until you've claimed the land before it does.
Yeah, that's another issue, too. That was a surprise, finding out that the envoys is what makes those cities grow. If they don't get any envoys, they would just stay small and not be particularly powerful.
TJ?
I think...
You've been playing for a while, I know, but there has to have been a surprise at some point.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the biggest one. Like, there have been a lot of interesting things in this game. You know, I haven't been quiet about it. The Civics Tree is my favorite thing to happen to Civ in all of the games, just because you can drastically change the way you're playing at any given Civics unlock.
Well, remember, they hinted around at that with Civilization Beyond, or whatever they called it, you know, the space one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Alpha Centaurus, you know, they hinted at it. They initiated that sort of mechanic, you know. I didn't think it was done particularly well in that game, but they really nailed it in Civ 6.
Yeah, it's so awesome, just the way that you can change up your style throughout the game. Like, if you don't like the way things are going, just swap out your cards. Figure out a new direction. And there's so many different cards that you can... Like, people are going to be working it out on chalkboards and rooms full of yarn what the best meta for Civics trees are.
Definitely.
For every Civ.
Oh, please, they do that for Monopoly, and Monopoly is Monopoly. You know, they say, oh well, you know, actually the green buildings are actually better than the blue territories because they pack more polymer and they take up more space. Blah 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 blah. I also like a lot of the small things. For instance, now they just lumped in camping with animal husbandry, because you know, in all the civs, camping was just a big bleh. I mean, at best, it got you to archery.
Mm-hmm.
But it was. Did you hate having to get camping? It's like, oh yeah, so I get an extra food for putting it on that deer over there. Whoop de doo.
Well, you also need it for the furs and I think truffles and a couple other elephants.
That, but I'm just saying they lumped in camping camps.
Yeah.
With the animal husbandry, which makes a lot more sense, and it makes it less of a hassle, you know. And the funny thing is that. This is the first Civ I've played in a long while where I've never had one of those bottlenecks, you know, where you only have one or two Civs that you can choose.
I got a bottleneck. It happened to me. I had to do defensive tactics on the Civics tree.
You get the bottlenecks on the Civics tree. I'm talking about the tech tree.
Mm-hmm.
You seldom ever have that tech bottleneck. I mean, I get the bottleneck all the time in the Civic Street, but I don't really care about that, you know?
Yeah.
This is just giving you a bunch of options to use and that you may or may not use.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, one of the great things about this also is the, and I hate hogging this up, I'll let you guys comment on this, is the fact that if you take certain actions, it actually accelerates your research, even if it's a technique you're not currently doing. For instance, if you happen to build a coastal city, the game says, hey, guess what? You're building a coastal city means that you guys really want to start working on sailing, you know? Or if you take out a barbarian encampment, it says, oh, you know, taking out the barbarian encampment makes them really want to try military tradition, you know? So it makes a lot of sense that performing certain actions will lead to your people saying, hey, wait a minute, if we're doing this, we might as well research this tech. And it becomes a lot easier to research because they've been doing it already.
Yeah, I think I found that I feel like you have to plan for a lot of this, because sometimes I find myself not taking a tech yet because I haven't got the Eureka yet, and that tends to make me delay getting the tech at all, and it requires a lot of planning, I think.
I mean, I'll do archery, and what happens is, while the researching archery, if I happen to make a slinger and he happens to kill a unit, then it'll just get done a lot faster, you know. And sometimes it'll very often when you do that, it'll be like, oh, you killed that guy with a slinger. Oh, by the way, now you have archery.
Yeah, but
because you're researching it, and now it's there.
There have been instances where it's like, okay, now you got to build three mines. Now you got to build an iron mine, and I don't have any iron to get that Eureka. And then another one's like learn construction, but you got to build a water mill first. And so it's a lot of planning out to do, I think.
Yeah, that's one of the irritating things is I keep on not being able to find iron anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's really annoying.
I want to say something crazy here.
Okay.
I never waste science points on archery, and I think it comes from the civs that I play, that like almost every one of them has a specific. I guess the Scythians have a unit that's basically a cavalry archer that you can get early and. The Egyptians have the chariot archer. I hate archery because it's a dead end. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm gonna tell you something. I found that a well positioned archer was able to hold off swordsmen one after one after one after. They were inside the encampment. I had the bonuses for him for getting plus 10 in the encampment, and I had my plus my military bonus on it. And they would just one-shot these guys. So, yeah, I mean, depending on the way you play, I'm fighting... one of the things that I sort of find a little bit cheeky is that you'll know right away when a civ is thinking about attacking you. Because all of a sudden they'll have hundreds of these units just happen to be wandering around your area and massing. It's like, oh, dear God, they're going to attack now. I know it.
Like India was in our game, TJ, remember?
Oh, my God.
And the thing is that I just, you know, I just built three archers and a few meat shields, and I took care of them. And, who was it who attacked me? Anyway, she just said, oh, by the way, yeah, you're weak! Oh, maybe you're not so weak. Oh, it's Cleopatra. also, oh, we have to get into that, and you guys can discuss this.
Oh, the hidden agendas you have to figure out, and then also their base agenda, too. It was really weird. I was trying to get Gandhi to like me, but I was kept pissing him off and making him happy for unknown reason, so I could never figure it out, and apparently I had to be France to figure out whatever it was that was pissing him off. So that's really unfortunate, but...
You have to, in order to learn the hidden agenda, you have to either be the enemy of them that exposes it,
mm-hmm.
or you have to be friends with them, and
instead of a crap ton of envoys.
Yeah.
And it can be really painless, too. I mean, all you have to do is send money as a little gift, and they'll either say no or yes.
Mm-hmm. I tried to send Gandhi delegations, like, all the time, and he would never take them.
I know, he was being a pain in the butt.
I mean, they will say outright what they like, their not hidden motivation. For instance, I was killing barbarians, and Germany said, "Hey, you're killing barbarians! Good job, dude!" And sometimes I say, why are you letting barbarians run through your country? So apparently, he likes it when I kill barbarians.
Yeah, and America will get real pissed with you if you start wars on the same continent as them.
Yeah, that's his big stick policy.
Oh, God. And here's the thing. Continents are so random, and you don't know where they begin and end. I'll build a city and walk two steps, and oh, you're in a new continent. And there's nothing to indicate you're in a new continent. I mean, continents are that for a reason. I mean, Europe and Asia are actually one continent, Eurasia. But let's go with Europe and Asia, right? There's a clear division between Asia and Europe. And there's a clear division between Europe and Africa. Here in this game, there's no indication. You just right-click on a tile and say, oh, you're in Europe. Oh, you're in Mu. Oh, you're in Larinia, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you really can't tell when you're actually going into a new... And it's kind of cheap to just walk two steps. Oh, by the way, you're in another continent.
You know, when you click on the indicator that shows that... the notification that comes up when
Who uses that, really?
On that, it brings up, like, colored tiles that shows you where the line is. And there's... I guess maybe, like, I just haven't dug through it, but there's got to be a button somewhere where you can just get a look at that.
The lenses. It's the continent lens. It'll show you where the continents are.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lens. Similar to the one that you're Oh, that's another thing. They revamped the entire irrigation thing, and now when you have your settler, you can see, and it'll also tell you which tiles are wet.
Yeah, where fresh water is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I do find that very useful. I love the lenses, and I love the pens. I'm glad we have the pens back, where we can at least mark the tiles where we want stuff.
I was about to say, aren't you kind of young to be wearing the pens?
I said pens. Clean out your ears, Jonah.
So, diplomacy, do you like it or not?
I don't know, it was kind of annoying, because like I said, I was trying to make peace with Gandhi. Gandhi had this agenda, he had peacemaker agenda, whereas like he would not declare a war that made him a warmonger, so I thought, okay, let's be buddies. But apparently that wasn't enough, because he had a hidden agenda that was making him mad, and I never figured out whatever that was. I probably built something he wanted. That's usually what pisses off civs.
Go ahead, TJ.
I haven't had any problem with it. I think it's a cool way to give the AI personality. The AI is never going to be as compelling as a human character, but the diplomacy and the agendas certainly add another level of depth to an AI game.
Certainly.
Do you want to talk about Sean Bean? Yeah, one of the nice little things that I only noticed like in my third playthrough was that not all the texts have... Sometimes the texts have more than one quote, and that was kind of neat. I mean, for Animal Husbandry, one was a quote by Winston Churchill, and the other one was by Will Rogers. I found it interesting that some of the quotes were from offbeat sources, like from Scott Adams, the creator of Dilbert.
Yeah.
And some of them were from bloggers. So I'm trying to figure out where they got some of these quotes. And some of them are really, really offbeat.
Yeah,
I haven't run into a blogger quote, but it makes me think.
There was a quote from a comedian. And
George Carlin?
No, not George Carlin.
Because George Carlin has a great quote in it.
Oh my god.
Life is what you make of it. Vegeta Sephiroth, 69.
That would be funny.
There's one quote by Will Rogers when he says, if you're digging and you're in a hole, stop. Another one is by Winston Churchill. It says he loves pigs because while dogs look up to us and cats look down at us, pigs look at us as equals.
Yeah, that was the one. Yes, I remember that one.
I'm trying to remember the George Carlin quote. It was hilarious.
I don't remember what tech it was, but there was a quote, and I didn't know who the guy was, so I looked him up. And, man, I can't remember the tech of the quote, but it was like... I'm gonna find it again when I play the game, and I don't remember now. I had to look up the person because I was like, "Who is this person?" But it was kind of frustrating during our multiplayer game because like his little text bubble would pop up and he would start talking, and somebody else was talking at the time, and they'd be like, "Oh, I can't hear you. I'm being interrupted."
Can I tell you how much I hate the bar notifications that come up in the middle of the screen when either someone attacks or something happens or someone builds something? And you why is there not an X button on the corner of that box, of any of those boxes, that you can just get rid of them? You have to wait for them to fade away while you're trying to get a look at what you want to do with your next Civic or your next technology.
Oh, there's even a Monty Python quote in when you get Divine Right. Listen, strange women lying in ponds, distributing swords, is no basis for a system of government. You can't expect to wield supreme power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you.
And there's an alternate one for that one as well, because the one I remember for getting divine right was a king, I can't remember what king said it, but basically saying that if talking against God is blasphemous...
Oh yeah, that's King Edward?
Yeah.
Yeah. Talking against God, but you know, if you talk against me, you're talking against God. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Basically, what he's saying. Yeah.
But yeah, when you have a Monty Python quote in a Civilization game,
that's awesome.
Speaking of Sean Bean, I really, really like the opening cutscene.
Yes, I agree. That opening thing is very awesome.
And the music is very James Horner-esque. It's like they decided to clone James Horner for doing that score.
I give credit to Chris Tin. His creativity is really good.
Well, it's not just Christopher Tin this time. Actually, he's the third credited composer.
Right. Well, he did Sanga Devere, but I can't remember the names. I think there's a Jeff something and another person that did the rest of the soundtrack. But he just did one song for the game.
I mean, Jeff Noir did most of the sound.
Yeah.
Also, Rick Bucher? I forget his name. Is it Rick Bucher? No. I'm trying to remember now, but yeah. They have I got the soundtrack, and most of it is the ambient music, which is pretty good. I will say it's not as good as Civ 4's ambient music, which is really good. Because in Civ 4, every Civ had their own little theme. In this one, it seems to be just a generic. I mean, it's nothing that's going to irritate the heck out of you. You know, it's very soothing.
The ancient era might sound a little generic being one instrument, but they are all songs.
I heard all of them. I mean, they actually posted a 90 minutes of the music on YouTube.
Yeah.
And everybody reacted to that because it was okay. But the opening theme is really good. It rivals Baba Yetu as a Civ theme. It's very grand. It's very adventurous. Mm-hmm. And a little twist at the end was really fun with the moon shot. We won't give it away, but you know, it's a fun little twist and heartwarming too. So getting away from Civ 6, which we've talked to death now. The other big thing that happened on that day, aside from the announcement of what the NX is going to be called, was the reveal of Red Dead Redemption 2. So, TJ, what did you think of the teaser trailer?
Boring.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's harsh.
We didn't see anything new out of that.
We did see something new. We saw. See, the thing about that trailer was it was showing off the West as a character, its own character. And by the way, the graphics look fantastic.
Yeah, they do. But like, there's nothing different about it.
I feel like maybe if I'm reading too much into this, but I feel like they're implying you get a gang. Or you're working.
Yeah, well,
with
that's definitely.
Game.
If you're gonna have a multiplayer, that's probably, you know. But the thing is that it's a teaser trailer.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. And basically, the teaser trailer it was there to say, "Hey, guess what? Red Dead Redemption 2 is a thing."
Yeah.
But I'm gonna say something. You know, the graphics are really good. The only thing I'm worried about is that I don't want to see another Watch Dogs 2.
What does that have to do with? You mean you don't want?
They stretch the graphics in that thing. You know, and it's like the Red Dead Redemption was pretty, the first one, especially when you first enter. Everybody raves about when you first enter Mexico. It may be pretty, but there was a lot more to it than just pretty graphics. Even on the Xbox One, it looked great. They did graphically upgrade it. So I'm cautiously hopeful. There's still a lot of question of who's going to be the protagonist.
Right.
I don't think it's going to be Jack Marston.
Hoping for...
Just call it a hunch.
I'm hoping it would, new story.
No, it would be so cheap. You know, it would be so, you know, on the nose to have Jack Marston as the protagonist. But it is good. It does seem it's going to... Like Scott was worried about, it is going to take place in the Old West. It's not going to take place in modern times. One of the things is that there were certain hints that it might be taking place in the older West and how the West became. So we'll see about that.
So it might be a prequel.
Yeah, that's basically it. Some people are saying that there's going to be some shout-outs to Red Dead Revolver in it, but that's pure speculation. So aside from being bored by it, TJ, what did you get out of it?
I got that there's a fort, there's a gang, there's a wilderness, and there's a little sleepy town, which is all of the things that were in Red Dead Redemption. So, I don't know. I was hoping to... The graphics were great, but I hope it's just not a retread of those exact same beats, just because it's quite a few years removed from the original.
Scott?
I'm interested and intrigued. Again, it's a teaser, so I can't really expect too many details in the moment. So, again, I'm interested to see more, see, you know, what they're going to do. I'm glad it's, you know, staying in the West, and I won't mind if it's a prequel in this instance.
You know, maybe they should go all the way back. And I don't mean all the way back, but I mean like the early 1800s. I mean when there were very few white people out there and it was mostly Native Americans and dealing with that, you know, sort of like just after the war of, what's it called, the Revolutionary War, when people are just starting to go out. I mean, during the French and Indian War, you know, during the times of Hawkeye, you know, Chingachgook and stuff like that. It would be nice to have it during that period. Remember, here's the thing: the West used to be just west of Kentucky, you know. So, yeah. I mean, it doesn't have to be west of the Mississippi River. And that's one thing, though. That is one thing that I'm willing to bet you it's going to be that the map. Oh, actually, they already leaked that, didn't they? That the map for Red Dead Redemption 2 is going to be incredibly huge.
Yes.
Wasn't that like last year? It's like it's going to be. The map we had in Red Dead Redemption, the new map is going to be three times as big or something like that?
Yeah.
That'll be cool.
So maybe they're going to encompass more of the United States. Hey, how about this? Imagine if it encompassed the entire, from coast to coast, United States. So you have to go from New York City to St. Louis to, you know, to Denver or whatever.
That would be a crazy big game right there.
but it would also be very welcome. And you keep in mind, you know, people like Wild Bill Hickok visited New York a lot. You know, I mean, the heroes of the West made their money doing the ballyhoos with, you know, with Ringling Brothers and other stuff like that. You know, because people were fascinated with the Old West. Now, that would make it a sequel to Red Dead Redemption, in which it's taking place in the early 1900s, but that's not bad either.
You'd also do, you'd also play around with the idea of the cattle drive that took, that went all the way from Texas up to Kansas City.
Oh, dear. Well, they better make it a lot more fun. I mean, second time playing through Red Dead Redemption, the cattle drive wasn't as annoying, because I guess I honed my skills. But make it less of a, oh, I have to chase every single cow and make sure a lot of them don't jump off to their deaths like lemmings. That was the annoying part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, aside from that, what have you been... Well, actually, we discussed what we've been playing. Now, I know that Scott sent me a news item. It's kind of a minor one, but he sent me a news item regarding the new third-party PS4 controllers. And he said, you know, and I saw, yeah, one of them does look like an Xbox One controller.
Mm-hmm. I thought that would be at least amusing, because I know you like the dual sticks in that position. Me, I'm fine either way. I don't know why people get so fixated on it. It's just like an inch over, big whoop. But, you know, apparently they're fighting holy wars over the position of these joysticks on the freaking controller. It's like Star Wars versus Star Trek. Why? I don't know.
Didn't the Nintendo 64 have the thumbsticks in that orientation too? It's not. I know the Dreamcast
has the most weirdest controller ever. The most awkward and weirdest.
No, not the first one. I'm talking about the subsequent one.
The GameCube one
they released.
The GameCube.
No, the Nintendo 64. I don't know. I remember that they went from that winged whatever it is to something a little more Nintendo-like. But you know what? Here's the thing. You know, there's no such thing as ripping off in controllers, because basically, you know, you have something called ergonomics, and what people find comfortable is what they're going to find comfortable. You know? I mean, yeah, so you have twin sticks. So what? That's because you have two hands. You know?
I will say the sticks make a difference from, like, certain types of games. I'll say this. I play fighting games on a control pad, and I can't do it on a Xbox One controller, because the...
You're not using a Hori or something like that? Come on.
Nah, I don't have $200 to spend on a fight stick right now. but the actual, like, having to stretch my thumb to actually, because I'm not a huge fan of using the sticks on fighting moves, because I've always just been I'm a Super Nintendo kid. Yeah. I like the D-pad, and having to stretch my thumb to reach that center spot for inputs on the Xbox One controller always kind of drove me crazy. I always preferred the PS4 one.
I wonder what you'd think of the Elite controller, because it has that swap out from traditional D-pad to that, like, flat. You know, that bowl-shaped D-pad?
I think I would like it. I've seen it, and it looks a lot more... it looks a lot more, like, intuitive for a physical standard of, like, the way my hands are.
Yeah, by the way, getting back to the original article, it seems to me that the concept of an Elite controller is really starting to take off, and you now have boutique controllers. I mean, I know that one manufacturer was doing Elite Xbox One controllers before Xbox and also for other things, but now it's like everybody's saying, you know what, people are paying for having a boutique high grade pro controller, with really good parts that aren't going to break down. And you know, it's a good sign, because you know, it's sort of like saying, okay, you have your $150 controller here, you have your $60 controller here, and you have those $30 controllers, which I often buy whenever, you know, as a backup in case one of my controllers breaks, you know. And it's we're getting to a good place there, you know, good shit that's not going to break, your standard controller, budget controller.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess so, I don't like it when the cheaper ones break down. It makes me feel like I need to buy the more expensive one that'll last longer.
You know, GameStop released their own controller, and that thing lasted forever.
I don't know, my batteries seem to die on these PlayStation controllers. They stop working.
Speaking of batteries dying, we're going to go into the Nintendo. that story's not yet. But that was another story that we... that I did include. Yeah, I guess we can discuss it when we discuss the new Nintendo console. But yeah, there's a lot of speculation that those controllers are going to have 3-hour battery lives, and that's not a good thing when you have a handheld.
Yeah.
No.
So, anyways, but we're going to go to right now to the news that's been making waves the past 48 hours, I think. Bethesda says no more to advanced game reviews. This comes from Kamasutra. Traditionally, when game publishers are interested in day one game reviews, they'll work with various media outlets to help them secure advanced copies so they can have a review ready by launch day. But today, one publisher, Bethesda Softworks, has seemingly shot down that idea for good. In a post on a company blog, Bethesda Global Content Lead Gary Steinman writes that following the launch of Doom earlier this year, it will now be company policy to only supply review copies of games to media outlets a day in advance. It's not an entirely surprising move, since Bethesda has expressed a somewhat negative attitude towards press and reviewers in recent years, but it also seems that Bethesda is making this policy official to draw distinction between reviews and Let's Play streams of its games. As some of the writers have pointed out, Bethesda has already issued copies of the Elder Scrolls V Skyrim Special Edition to YouTubers, allowing them to showcase the first 2 hours of play and who are possibly less likely to be critical of the game. What's also interesting here is that Bethesda is far from the only company to have this kind of review policy, but it's one of the few that to actually acknowledge it exists. Blizzard, for instance, hasn't sent out review copies of its games for the past few years, and Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment, 2K, have been recently reluctant as well. Part of the reason that might be that Bethesda is interested in stemming discussions on the delayed review copies are an indication of a game's final quality. Steinman does allude to this. He says that we sent review copies to arrive the day before launch, which led to speculation about the quality of the game. Since then, Doom has emerged as a critical and commercial hit and is now one of the highest-rated shooters in the past few years. Of course, this move has drawn some criticism, which we're going to do in a few moments. It also, for the fact that Bethesda seems to be joining EA and allowing players to pay for one-day early access to its games. This means that players may lack some of the transparency in knowing the game's quality before making the purchase on their own. Steinman says, in anticipation of this criticism, we do understand that some of you want to read reviews before you make your decision. If that's the case, we encourage you to wait for your favorite reviewers to share their thoughts. This is the Bethesda also is the first company this year to make waves for visibly prioritizing YouTubers over traditional media outlets. Sony, for instance, gave YouTuber PewDiePie access to the long-awaited game The Last Guardian months before its final official release. Okay, so hack away, and I will have something after that.
That line, we encourage you to wait for your favorite reviewers to share their thoughts, is a freaking joke. Because they say that in that letter, all the while every single outlet anywhere is them pushing, hey, pre-order, get this thing, pre-order, make sure you pre-order, you want to get this thing, don't you, pre-order.
Yeah, you get the DLC for free that you might have to pay for later.
So the idea that they're encouraging people to wait for their favorite review is like, whatever, dude. This isn't something that benefits anything but Bethesda, and I get why they're doing it, but it's still crappy.
It might not benefit them as much as they think. Well, we'll continue. Scott, go ahead. I know you're just ready to tear into them, because you were complaining about this for the past few days.
Well, the whole promoting stuff, pre-order stuff, yeah. I didn't pre-order Tyranny, for instance, because I don't know, I don't really think I need to, and there's...
Well, Tyranny isn't a pre-order. That's a Kickstarter.
That's a Kickstarter one, but you can still pre-order it. I think it hasn't come out just yet. But as far as not giving out the review copies, you know, that's just going to hurt their sales, I think, in some cases. Because people will then just be like, fine, I'll wait and for this game to actually come out. And
well, that's the problem, isn't it? Because with Bethesda, they're going to say, oh, you really want to wait for Fallout 5? Or you really want to wait for the next Elder Scrolls? Or do you really want to wait? You know, so they have to, they're in the position to do this because they have major titles that they know people are going to buy sight unseen.
Yeah. Yeah, just like, there are big fans that'll buy any game sight unseen, so it doesn't matter to them. I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't know why they were bothering to do this if they don't want to, get good word of mouth out. You know, that seems like the one of the
biggest... like I just said, you know, the good word of mouth is the fact that it's that franchise. I mean, hey, TJ, Dishonored 2. That's being published by Bethesda. Are you going to wait for the reviews to get it?
Probably not.
See, there's the rub, though, isn't it?
and it's stupid, too, because they're saying they're basically saying, well, we don't care about reviews if it's before the game's release, but at the same time, they're not going to shirk putting those accolades like the E3 Editors Awards and preview hype on their site. Like, this is what this publisher said about it. They're basically taking all the accolades and trying to minimize the risk.
Now, there is a double-edged sword to this, and we're going to call it bugs. Now, review copies, you know, typically reviewers just have like a week to review a game, right? And a lot of games, and I'm going to point out NBA 2K17, have really bad bugs that only happen later in the game. And here's the thing. If you're going to force reviewers to review a game, okay, on launch day, well, we're going to now take our time to review the final product. And what they start seeing is they spend more time with it, and their review scores are going to go down and down and down and down. Here's the thing, Bethesda. You're not going to stop people from reviewing your games. It's impossible. The thing is, you can control the pre-release a lot more. You can control the post-release. You want a big example? Batman Arkham Knight. How many positive reviews did that thing get? It got a ton of positive reviews. Because the reviewers, they were playing on either very good machines that didn't have the same problems, right? Or they were playing on a console and they were just quickly getting the review that they couldn't really dwell on that game. But the longer Batman Arkham Knight was out, the worse it got, the worse word of mouth. Now imagine if they didn't have that pre-release to review, and instead reviewed the final product, all of a sudden you're seeing Batman Arkham Knight would be getting fives and fours, instead of the eights, you know, the middle eights that it got. And the reason why I got those middle eights is because people weren't crazy about the story. Mm-hmm. But the longer you played that game, the more the flaws were exposed, and especially on the PC version, like I said, because the PC versions that a lot of reviewers got were played just fine and dandy. There was no bugs with those. But when it gets out in there, you know, everybody has a different PC, and a lot of people got really bad bugs and a lot of bad word of mouth, and that game was a disaster from day one on PC.
Yeah.
But it still got high review scores, even from Game Watcher, because... or relatively high, you know, B's, because they didn't have time to review it. They had to review it really quickly. People are going to spend that time now. So, yeah, I think this may backfire on Bethesda in that regard, in which they're going to find their review scores going down because people are spending more time with the games.
I hope it backfires. It's a lopsided business decision that's totally... you can see... from top to bottom, this is something that Bethesda wants to do that's only going to... that they want to pretty much only to benefit them in the end.
And the thing is, they're going to find out what movies have known for decades, and that is the only time that you don't have reviews on the day of launch is when it's a really bad movie. You know? Because you know what the best hype is? From reviews. Word of mouth is word of mouth. You know, that's after it. But you know what? People were really loving... what's it called? They were really excited about No Man's Sky now, weren't they?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the hype was, behind that was unreal. I don't know how that got hyped so high.
It was two parts. It was Sony and Hello Games combining... I mean, Sony decided to put it front and center and made it seem like a $60 game, which it wasn't. And Hello Games decided to make a $60 game, but also blatantly lied about features, you know, and they're still silent. Have we heard from them, TJ? I don't think so.
No. radio silent since, I think, August 30th?
It's going to be very interesting when they decide to release a new game, how people are going to react to it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, well, I can't really say a good game is going to be a good game and people are going to love it, but then I remember DMC, which is actually the best game in the series, gameplay-wise and aesthetic-wise, but people just didn't like it because it wasn't Devil May Cry.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You know...
Go ahead.
And that's actually a good point to your point, is that people weren't into the style, but as people discovered it, that game has a cult following and people love it and people have bought it, and I've heard from multiple sources, including you, that it's the best out of the series.
But like I said, you know, I mean, people already had issues with what Bethesda was doing. I mean, Scott, you had some DLC issues before, didn't you? I remember you were talking about how some of the content that was released really didn't meet up to your expectations.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot to them. I think I remember Homestead, you just built your house, you adopt a kid, and it didn't really add much. The Solstheim was good, I think. I'm sorry, we're talking about Fallout. Yes, that's right, I remember that. The workshop stuff, and Far Harbor was good. I liked that. But
it was a major single player content release.
Yeah, and it was, you know, and then you had the whole Nuka world where you can kill the bandits or do all their bidding and stuff. But there wasn't, like, I would have loved if you went there and you had the option to, like, bring the Minutemen in or the freaking Brotherhood in and really clean town, like, go to war, you know, go to war with these bandits. That would have been awesome. But
here's the main story.
Very like, oh, you want to kill everyone? Okay, they all hate you. Now I just slog through killing everyone all by yourself. It's not as interesting.
But here's the main point. What did most people do? They had to pre-order that shit.
Yeah, they did. That's
pass,
right.
Pass, you know, so without knowing exactly what it was going to be.
This is true.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, you're taking a lot of things on faith. Bethesda has to be careful here, because if they do a slip-up, it's going to backfire in that way. Just ask Hello Games.
Right.
You know, you can, if you want to drive up the hype, fine. And if you don't want to have reviews until 24 hours beforehand, fine. And I'm pretty sure that a lot of sites are going to be really happy they have 24 hours to play a game that might take 60 hours to complete. And, you know... The thing is that if the reviewers are starting to get annoyed at you, they may not be as forgiving, you know. Because in a review like Fallout 4, you know, it was my game of the year for Game Watcher. And I said, you know, for every one thing that annoyed me, there were five things that I really liked. So even though there were certain things that really just, I don't really care about that. There was enough content, enough things going on that made me stick with the game. Now, suppose I was really pissed off at Bethesda, and I really was getting annoyed with what they were doing with other games, and now I have this, I might not be as forgiving. I might just start harping on stuff, you know? Because reviewers are human. Believe it or not, they're not robots. You know, they're gonna have a prejudice when reviewing your game. You know, I mean, they try to be as fair as possible. But you know, if you're someone like Topware, you know, you keep on releasing Two Worlds 2, and all that stuff, people are gonna say, yeah. Stop trying to push this on us. We're not getting it. You know, even if it's good, and it's final patch, which I hear Two Worlds 2 is, you know, it's finally a playable game. But you might as well sing it, you know, no one's going to listen to you anymore. I mean, teacher. Go ahead.
What's the name? Detroit Become Human. I know people that won't get that game specifically because it's David Cage. You want to talk about bad vibes? there's people that will not... I know people that will not get that game because David Cage is attached to it, and they're not going to take another chance on him.
Do they say, Jason, to you?
I think David Cage is the perfect example of, like, bad karma coming back to you.
People like Derek Smart are their own political attack ads, you know? And they come off really badly, even if they're trying their hardest, you know, and it's hard for them to get sympathy. You know, I know Derek Smart personally, and he just has an attitude that won't adjust itself. It's like, you know, I tell him, you know, you're ruining your own reputation here. You got to stop that. And he just won't listen. And he wonders why no one will buy his game Battlecruiser 3000. 80. And which is why he's really angry at Star Citizen, because Star Citizen is doing everything that he wanted to do with Battlecruiser 3000 AD. Anyways, like I said, I think it's going to backfire, and Bethesda's going to think better of it, because you're not always going to be reeling out hits after hit after hit. TJ?
Yeah, it's really disappointing, because I am going to get Dishonored 2.
Sight Unseen, yeah.
And I am probably going to check out... I'm going to keep a close eye on Prey, because I'm really interested.
Let's back up here, TJ. Now, suppose Bethesda did this, right? And then they announced the first Dishonored the next year. How eager would you be to play a new IP like that?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. If it's a different studio, like, say, Arkane, I'd probably be more interested. If it's a directly Bethesda-developed product, I might be more questioning.
You know, Arkane, there's a rumor that Arkane is going to be bringing back... Oh, we already did this last week, The Crossing. Never mind. We already discussed that. How about you, Scott?
Yeah, I think this could give them bad reputation, and they've had this good reputation of being a good developer, and now they like you said, need to be careful, because they could backfire and hurt that reputation, hurt that, you know, that desire to buy their game sight unseen. People might start being more cautious and be like, yeah, maybe I'll wait. Actually, will wait for those reviewers, and that could hurt the revenue.
That actually, you know, let's talk about you now, Scott. I mean, you were disappointed by the Fallout 4 DLC. Now they announced Fallout 5. Are you going to immediately pre-order it, or are you just going to wait for reviews? And even if you do pre-order it, are you going to be jumping on that season pass?
Probably not.
Yeah, also, by the way, changing the season pass cost in retrospect seems kind of sleazy now.
Yeah. Because I thought they were going to do more, and I guess not.
Because it was... They changed it to $50. At least they said, well, if you'd bought it for $30, don't worry, it's going to remain $30 for you. But now it's going to... After this date, it's going to be $50. And I think you probably, Scott, you probably believe that DLC release wasn't worth $50.
No, I mean, that freaking Nuka-Cola World was maybe $20 or less. And the I think it was the Vault. Vault was okay, but see, for me, like, that Vault DLC came way too late. I needed that in the beginning of the game. I needed that, like, as soon as I got out, somebody came up to me and said, "Hey, you want to rebuild this vault into a useful place?" And up in the, I would have been like, "Hell yeah!" But no, it's like I'm done with Fallout. I don't have time to deal with a vault. I got Civ 6 and other games to play now.
Actually, you know, you're starting to make it sound like you believe that there was a little bit of a Mona Lisa-ing going on there.
Yeah, it kind of does feel like that.
You could edit a vault, but they decided to slice it off and say, we'll just use it as DLC.
Yeah, where we could have... I mean, it would have been cool to have rebuilt Vault 111. That really would have sunk in and made it, like, a more iconic thing for me to have more relationship with it. Because, like, this is the first time you get out of the vault in under like 5 minutes, you know, it's so quick.
You know, the thing is that actually, to me, I think, yeah, have it in the main game, but he wouldn't be able to do it until after the game is over. Because really, I don't think he'd be able to reconcile having his dead wife there or dead having her dead husband there so quick. It's sort of like, oh, I don't want to go back there just yet until everything's resolved.
I don't know. I could see having it sort of a reminder of why I'm going out there and doing what I'm doing and build a shrine or something. But I don't know. It's just I'm just not really interested in building a vault, you know, that late into the game.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead.
One last thing before we move on. The other thing is that everyone who knows Bethesda and everyone knows that has ever played their open world games knows that day one or even day 50.
Oh, they're buggy as shit. Yeah.
People aren't going to get in on that immediately if they can't see what they're going to be expecting. Because we know, we're not stupid. If you've been there since Fallout 3, or Elder Scrolls 3, you know what Bethesda does on day one, and you know that you're going to be dealing with some terrifying bugs. Are you gonna go ahead and try to risk it on day one, or are you gonna wait until your reviewers tell you what you should expect?
I may do just that when they announce the next Elder Scrolls game, which I'm sure is coming in 2 or 3 years, and then
next year.
And when we get to it's not gonna be next year, and when they get there, it's gonna be I might just wait for Game of Year edition instead. You know where the whole thing is for like $10. Like you can get Skyrim now like the whole thing $5. You know, not the special edition. I know that. Yeah, that pissed you off, didn't it, TJ? The whole special edition thing remastered. I was like, garbage. Screw you guys. So yeah, I might be more cautious now because it was a little bit disappointed with the roleplay value. You know, it was a little bit low in Skyrim and lower in Fallout, and now I don't know if I trust them for the next Elder Scrolls. So we'll have to see.
You know, that makes me wonder how much of this is Bethesda and how much of this is ZeniMax.
I don't know. I know that Pete Hines is quickly becoming one of my least favorite people in the gaming industry.
So, yeah, with that upbeat note, let's move on to the next item. Go ahead, TJ.
Alright. Nintendo pins financial hopes on selling 2 million Switch consoles at launch, from Ars Technica. Nintendo is now expected to bring in roughly one-third of the money it did at the peak of the Wii Mania in 2009. The unexpected windfall from the success of Pokemon Go and the one-time sale of the Seattle Mariners notwithstanding. That's thanks in part to absolutely dismal sales for the Wii U. The company plans to sell only 800,000 systems worldwide in the entire fiscal year, which led Nintendo to cut both its full-year revenue and operating income targets in an earnings release last night. With the present looking pretty dismal financially, Nintendo is increasingly pinning its hopes of turning things around with its just-unveiled Switch console. Nintendo president Tatsumi Kimishima says that the company expects to ship 2 million units before the fiscal year ends in March. That's 2 million system launch. That 2 million system launch is smaller than the 3.06 million Wii U systems Nintendo shipped during its launch quarter in 2012. That comparison isn't too useful, though, since the Switch number will represent less than a month of sales, compared to about a month and a half for the Wii U's launch quarter. The Switch is also launching in March rather than the busy holiday season in which the Wii U launched. Unlike the Wii U, which Nintendo initially sold at a loss to try to build a base for software sales, Kimishima says the company won't go into the red selling Switch hardware. But he added that the company is also listening to what consumers expect from us when setting price. It's not clear at this point if that means that Nintendo will sell the system at cost or with a small profit margin built in, but in either case, the Switch launch won't have a sizable financial impact on the company till the next fiscal year. Elsewhere, Kimishima confirmed earlier reports that Nintendo would not be elaborating on the Switch's hardware specs or price this year. Once the system is fully unveiled, though, there will be opportunities for players to sample the unique hybrid system in the wild before it hits store shelves, Kimishima said.
Okay, before we go into this, let's just describe, Scott, you can do this, of what Nintendo showed off in its debut trailer.
It showed off controller that I think I forget exactly what order things happened, but it was like they were playing around the TV, and someone gets up and they pull out like a little tablet from the rack, and then
from the base system, yeah.
Yeah, they put little two tiny side controllers to it, and then they walked around with that, and then I think they went up to a party where another person had a game, and they put them, like, back-to-back to each other, and then I think they went back down, and they have a crazy controller setup. They have this little, like, hand controller that comes apart, and you attach it to the tablets, and then they have this regular controller that I guess connects to the usual base when you have the tablet in there. So they have.
And it looks a lot like an Xbox One controller too.
Yeah, when they're put together, it looks like an Xbox One controller. But you can and these two tablets, these two tiny controllers, these Joy-Cons, are very small little controllers where they have like a joystick and a couple little buttons. And they're so tiny, I think they're too little for me, maybe.
They remind me of a Wiimote a little bit.
Yeah, and I wonder if it can be good for a left-handed person, because, like, they look mirror of each other. And they've already made jokes about it looking like a puppy dog when it's put together. It looks like a little dog. So I like the color scheme, and I think some people have put up some... of different variants of what it could look like, you know, with a Zelda one or just red or whatever. You know, so I mean, it looks okay. I don't hate it. So, you know,
Although there is that rumor about battery.
That could be a deal killer right there.
How about you, TJ?
That brings up an interesting question. I wonder if each little Joy-Con requires a battery.
That's a good point. I mean, do they have their own battery? Are they Bluetooth and using the tablet's battery? That's, yeah.
Find out. Nintendo has a deal with Duracell, and you have to use AAA batteries in each one.
Well, that's right. They're using the cell phone technology, so it might actually be Bluetooth. Those little controllers might be Bluetooth.
Yeah, NVIDIA confirmed that the Switch is using a modified Tegra processor.
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically their cell phone processor.
I think this whole thing is interesting. I think it's what Nintendo needed to do, was come out with something that would make people say, well, that's new. That's something I haven't seen before.
But Grandma want to play with it. That's the problem.
And, well, yeah, because you can take one of the little Joy-Cons off, and it's like an old-school Nintendo controller with a joystick and two buttons.
Aside from playing The Legend of Zelda, they also had it playing Skyrim.
Yeah, and then Bethesda would not confirm that game was actually being played on Nintendo, which to me seems like false advertising if Nintendo is showing something erroneously, or they're just jumping the gun, it's just so weird. Maybe
it's Dragon's Dogma, man. It just looks a lot like it. I don't know. I mean, here's a question. Hey, I just had this idea, TJ. Would you buy it if you could play Dark Souls with it?
Jeez, I don't know.
Yeah, I think the answer is I already have it on PlayStation. Why would I buy it on Nintendo?
Because you can do it while walking around.
No, that's a bad idea.
Of course, if you have a multiplayer and you link them up and you could play multiplayer Dark Souls...
I would not take Dark Souls out of the house. People would hear me screaming and I'd be...
I knew TJ was a sensible person.
Why the fuck did that guy jump out of that corner right there? I hate this. Are you insane, sir? No, I'm fine. I'm just playing Dark Souls.
Well, I have to copyright that idea. Hey, Capcom, guess what? Or is it Konami? Is it Capcom or Konami?
Dark Souls is Bandai Namco.
Oh, okay. See, one of those three. See, Bandai Namco. That was my idea. So if you use it, you have to pay me.
I think you have to trademark it first.
Multiplayer Dark Souls on the Switch.
But no, I think Nintendo did what they needed. Okay, so this is something I've mentioned before, and I'm calling it right now. So it's somewhere. It's written down in the annals of history. 2017, top-selling gaming accessory is going to be a replacement Joy-Cons. I'm calling it right now. Because those things
Right, you mean soft. Like with the original Wii and people flinging them into their TV? Although that was... The TVs were the ones that had to be replaced, not the controllers.
I can't believe people were that dumb to do that.
No, I'm talking about the fact that those Joy-Cons are tiny and you take them with you everywhere. People are going to lose them. children are definitely going to lose them, but people will probably lose
just,
them.
Just like that new iPhone, this is iPhone 7 little headphones, those little tiny things, I swear they're going to get lost, too.
Yeah. I'm calling it now. Joy-Cons are going to be the top-selling video game accessory of
consoles. just to replace them.
The biggest question, of course, is going to be the price, and that's what everybody is wondering about. Because if this thing comes out at like $500, yeah, it's not going to sell 2 million.
Yeah.
Or even $400 might be a little bit much. I mean, yeah, it looks cool, but it looks kind of plasticky. You know, it looks kind of cheap.
But it's like you said, like if this is straight up cell phone technology, cell phones cost a lot of money, and who knows?
Well, they said a modified Tegra, so we also have to wonder if the graphics we're seeing on the screen from, like, Skyrim is actually what you're going to get. I mean, you can dumb down the graphics of Zelda. No one cares. Because, you know, Zelda is a retro game, even if it has state-of-the-art graphics. You know, it still has that retro feel. So if you have a little bit of blockiness, especially if you're looking at it on a small screen, no one's going to care. But, you know, when you're playing something on a TV, is it going to upscale if it's a modified Tegra chip? You know, if it's going to be a cell phone picture on a TV? I don't know. You know? If Nintendo makes a deal with AT&T, you know something's up. Oh, that was the other thing that people were very confused about. That they thought that you're gonna have to have a mobile carrier to play the Switch. People were assuming that Nintendo had said, no, you can play it offline. But you have to wonder if multiplayer online is gonna be its main strength, especially if it's gonna be, you know, if it's gonna be a you know, basically a modified cell phone.
That, and they clearly want to give people an idea that this is gonna be used for esports, so obviously online is going to be a thing. And they obviously want it to be a big thing.
Scott?
I don't like that at all. Especially when you say, oh, you can play it offline. Oh, okay, so what's the... So it's like PlayStation Plus or Xbox Gold or whatever it's called. I don't like those options.
I mean,
I don't mind it. I get a lot of free games through that.
Yeah.
You know, actually, I don't know, because, like I said, you know, a three-hour battery life, you know, it's just... Here's the thing, when you play a mobile game, whether it's a mobile or a handheld console, usually you want the smaller form thing. I mean, you can have a big... You know, Zelda works well on handheld, you know, I'll say that. Hmm. But usually, you know, you want to have small bites of experience, which is... And you also don't want to worry about your battery life while you're playing. You know, that's the biggest thing. You're in the middle of a big dungeon. You're about to get one of the cave boss. Oh, sorry, there goes your battery. Although I will say, you know, tech has gotten to the point in which you can they probably flash save, you know, where you can just, when you boot it up, it'll be right where you left it off. I mean, the Xbox One does that. The PlayStation 4 does that.
You're going to have to carry a 20-pound pack of AAAs along with you wherever you go.
Oh, my God.
If it uses batteries. I mean, if this is using a Tegra, it could basically be a USB charge.
If that's true, you can get one of these little... I have a couple of them where there's a little power cell thing that you can charge up, and then you plug in your phone to it or whatever, and it'll
charge. Yeah, but that begs the question, though. Isn't that an accessory you shouldn't have to get for handheld?
Yeah, you shouldn't have to get it. That's true.
You know, I mean, it's like an extra cost. And God forbid, you know, Nintendo makes that that bug into a feature. Get the special Nintendo charging kits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see. I mean,
this is something I'm definitely not pre-ordering. I'm going to wait for it to come out in reviews. I'm going to wait for people to talk about it and dissect it and do videos about it and angry reviews. And
I mean, TJ is right in that this is taking a niche that's not there yet, you know? It's not quite a mobile, it's not quite a handheld, it's not quite a console. The problem with that is you don't want something that's master of none, you know, and jack of no trades. I mean, people aren't going to want something that's bad at everything, you know, at least have one thing that you're really good at.
I kind of feel that way about iPhones in general, and all the smartphones, is that they're not really great at a lot of stuff. I mean, the photos are fuzzy, and it's just...
Oh, yeah. No. Well, my Galaxy 5, and especially the Galaxy 7, which I'm going to get at some point, the video, you can shoot in 4K, and you have low light. So, yeah, I mean, that it does really well, and that's not even its main purpose. Mm. I mean, it's funny, cell phone's purposes, you know, the phone part is sort of like the feature that you don't really use that much of a smartphone. I don't use my smartphone mostly for calling or even texting. I use it for other stuff.
It's just annoying when I'm trying to listen to music and somebody calls, you know, or push notices or anything interrupting my music, damn it.
Yeah, you saw, hey, you interrupted my listening of Whitesnake. What's going on here?
I was listening. I like On the Road Again, On the Road Again. That's a good song, damn it.
That's Kenny Rogers.
No, I think it's Whitesnake. It's like, I'm on...
Really? They did that.
Damn it, I'm not getting there. On the Road... Not. No, you're thinking of that other song. No, I'm thinking about the song where it's like, I was born to walk alone, like a hurricane or something like that. It's, no.
Oh, okay.
Not the Kenny Rogers song.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it's gonna really be about the price. We're forgetting about battery life, forgetting about that. It's gonna be the price. If it's $250, even I might get one.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that would be the sweet spot for me, is like $250. But like I said, if Nintendo really says it's not gonna sell it at a loss, we'll see. Anyways, we're gonna move on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
Okay. Let's see. Microsoft announces a VR headset for $299. This from PC Gamer. Microsoft announced a new line of virtual reality headsets today, which are much more affordable than others on the market. The headsets will come from Microsoft's partners, including HP, Dell, Lenovo, Asus, and Acer, and will start at just $299, which will be over $300 with tax. The announcement came during Microsoft Windows 10 event today, and headsets will be first to ship with Inside Out 6 Degrees of Freedom sensors. What this means is that there won't be any need for any cameras or laser tracking systems. Not much information was given about the headsets today, but they appear to use a similar technology to Oculus Santa Cruz prototype. The headset itself looks to have a headband with the visual part attached to the front, much like Sony's PlayStation VR headset. Microsoft unveiled the Windows 10 Creators update recently, and you can use this in conjunction with headset to create, share, scan, and print in 3D. In the demo, an image is created in Paint 3D and viewed in virtual world. Another demo entitled Holo Tour sees you enter a 3D video of real-world locations. Microsoft says you won't need a separate room for VR, and of course the big talking point here is the price. The likes of the HTC Vive and Oculus Rift cost $800 and $600, so Microsoft's headsets will cost half as much. These appear as though they'll be much more consumer-friendly than the $3,000 Microsoft HoloLens mixed reality headset. Yeah, that is a much better price, but I'm still not buying this thing.
Yeah. Well, like I said, we'll see the reviews. I mean, you get what you pay for, so,
yeah.
I mean, if it's cheap, we'll see if it's cheap. You know, it says starting at $300. So there could be a version of this that's like $600. That's you know, that's a high end use.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully it'll be better than the cardboard. But
yeah. I can't believe people bought the cardboard thing. I can't.
It was fun. It was cheap.
It just no.
I've been playing around on the PlayStation VR and I'm digging it, and I can see why Microsoft made this announcement now, because from what I understand, for the most part, PlayStation or Sony has sold through a lot of their stocks and a lot of their markets on it. And granted, it was a limited release, like 50,000 to 100,000 units in some markets. But the fact is that it's selling. And so, of course, Microsoft is going to come on board now and say, here's our version.
But it's not for the Xbox One. It's for Windows 10.
You don't think it'll be able to be used?
Oh, I'm pretty sure at some point that it'll transmit. But right now, they're focusing. You know what? I think Microsoft's going to wait until the Scorpio before they do any VR, because the Scorpio is going to be able to do good VR. You know, I mean, a really good VR, because it's going to be, you know, using 6 teraflops, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. You know, so that's I think they're waiting for the Scorpio to have one big bash. This and this and this. And I'm still not sold on VR. As Linkara said, you know, it's just a headset, you know, until you have a holodeck in which you can walk through the environment of holo created items. It's not going to be all that interesting anyway. That's what it's just. It hurt. You can't use it for very long either. So that's the main problem. But again, it's interesting to see a $300 VR headset. And one of the interesting things is that it's not being manufactured by Microsoft. They did the wise idea of telling all these companies, you can make your own version of this, like NVIDIA does with other people. Like NVIDIA will make their card, and then PNY and Asus and all these other people can make their own versions of that card. Basically, what Microsoft is doing is saying, you know, okay, HP, Dell, Lenovo, Asus, and Acer, you know, you can make your own versions of those cards, of this headset. And, you know, you can fight amongst each other to make the more attractive, better one. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I actually played Fable 3 with 3D glasses, and it was like, it was really good. It was one of the better 3D games I'd seen. So it'd be interesting to see what people come up with, because the big thing there, if you know, is the Creator's Update, which allows users to make their own stuff. And we've seen how creative people can be. Remember what people did with the PC Kinect? Is that some wonderful stuff? You can just imagine what people are going to come up with on their own doing VR.
Yeah. And I mean, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. It needs its killer app. It needs that thing that people are going to get in on. And for PSVR, I think they're getting close. I'm looking at Resident Evil 7 very closely, and I think that might come close to what they're looking for.
I'm going
to
tell you right now, never rely on Resident Evil to help you, ever. Resident Evil peaked at 4, and it's been shit ever since. So yeah, I'm not counting on Resident Evil to do anything. Especially what they named it.
Yeah. I mean, I've played through the demo several times, and I enjoy what I saw there. It didn't feel like... We make the comparison to PT, but it's not like that, because PT is sort of that Silent Hill style, and it was sort of that look in this direction and see something when it's there.
Oh, it's a little bit more than just a Silent Hill style. It was Silent Hills.
Yeah, and Resident Evil was more of the puzzle-solving aesthetic of actually go and interact with these things and find the object that fits in a certain place. And I think it reminded me of the beats of what made the first games good, that it's exploring the environment, finding the right objects, and then finding the place where they fit properly.
But, you know, when you say about killer app, I think it's more likely to come from some individual making their own thing independently. I mean, Scott, you'd agree that Minecraft is a killer app, right?
Definitely, for computer or any of these.
Killer app, period. I mean,
yeah.
And the thing is that it was basically one guy, and then he built a group around him that made Minecraft. You know, most likely the killer app isn't going to come from a corporation or a developer or anything like that. It's going to come from one person. They're going to have a brilliant idea, and that's going to take hold. I mean, it happens on a lesser scale, like Kerbal Space Program.
You remember at Sony's conference a couple years ago when they released that it was a trailer for this thing, I think it was called Dreams, where you could design all sorts of different cinematic things and artistic things in the game, and then sort of have them play out in a certain fashion. I think that would be super awesome in VR, but I don't know how you would go about doing it.
It reminds me of Microsoft attempting the family thing, and some of their press conferences around the same time too, which were just hilariously bad. Not quite on Wii Music bad, but still just awkward to watch.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like them saying, hey, look, we're cool and hip, and not really.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about that weird guy who was drumming in Wii Music. It was just bizarre. 2009 Nintendo conference was just freaking bizarre. I think that was the beginning of the end for them for at that point. They were starting their downward slope at that point. Anyways, so we don't have a question of the week. I mean, is there anything you'd like our listeners to answer? Let's just go with a straight obvious question. Are you prepared for VR? And you already answered that question, TJ, since you're already using VR. And Scott, I assume that you're not too crazy about it?
No.
Okay. I am not too crazy about it either. It's like 3D. It's like, it's spending a lot but not getting as much out of it. I mean, I will say that EVE Valkyrie game sort of intrigued me a little bit as a VR game, but it's not something that I'm going to spend $500 or $600 or $800 to play. Not to mention I still have to upgrade my computer just to do it.
Yeah, that's another thing, having to upgrade the computer. I'm hoping to not have to upgrade my own for a few years for now, until like I guess the next Elder Scrolls, if I even feel like playing that anymore.
So yeah, that's the question of the week. Are you ready for VR? We hope to hear from you out there. Certain people have been silent these past few weeks, and maybe us mentioning them will stir them into answering, because we haven't gotten mail last week. I didn't check the mail. Maybe there is mail, and I didn't even... Let me do this before we actually end the podcast to see if there is a message waiting for us. No one messaged. You know, it was a pretty big... And I like the title I gave it, Nintendo Pulls a Switch.
That works.
Yeah. So anyways, we will see you next week, and feel free to... what am I doing? I'm doing this all wrong. Look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net, along with industry news and our... I did that wrong again. Look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. If you enjoy your feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us some iTunes comments. I am at Jonah Falcon.
I am at Johnny Chugs.
And I am at Alpha Shard.
And we will see you next week.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Take care.
And that, as I say, is that. I will let you know how the recording is, or if you don't hear from me, Scott.
Just assume it's fine.
Yeah. But just keep that file around for a couple of days.
Sure, no problem.
Okay, bye-bye.